You are listening to The Mombcast, the best weekly comic book podcast recorded in Southampton, England on Thursday nights. In our 228th episode, we'll talk about this week's comics, and in this week's Spotlight, James will be talking about Daughter of Her Father's Eyes by Mary M. Talbot and Brian Talbot.
The Talbots.
The Talbots. Did you hear that little ah? I made a little noise.
I got a little thing stuck in my throat. I don't know, there's a little bit of spittle stuck in my throat then. I wasn't able to talk. What an awful start to the show.
You're doing fine, it's okay.
I'm so sorry, listener.
I thought you were emotional.
I can't handle the pressure.
Around the mic tonight are...
James.
Nick. And that's it. That's all. That's it. That's it. That's all there is. Is that a Beastie Boys song? I think that might be a Beastie Boys song.
It's like that.
How have you been this week? What have you been up to?
I've been getting older. I've been in London.
You had a birthday?
I did have a birthday, yeah.
And what was your London?
It was a work thing. It was on my birthday, but it was a work thing. But it's quite nice. It was at the QET Conference Centre, which is like kind of in Parliament-y square. So you walk over Westminster Bridge past Parliament, and it's so what you get to do, right? What you get to do, because I'm a provincial, so this is quite exciting. You get to walk in quite a touristy area, but like really. Really purposefully, like you know what you're doing, like you're a local. Out my way, I'm not a tourist. I'm a bit of local colour, like that.
Well, you're talking estuary English, which is basically like Cockney.
They probably think I'm local anyway. But you get to walk past Big Ben, the House of Parliament, which are beautiful buildings,
which are all around Parliamentary Square.
Yeah, all around that area. So yeah, it's quite a nice.
Why are you talking like that?
What?
What?
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
But it's quite nice. I said to him here, then I'm going to go up to Parliament, and I'm going to go to the QE2 Conference Centre, and I'm going to learn a little bit about these systems that I'm interested in, innit? You know what I mean? And then maybe we'll meet up with a dog and duck.
My week has basically all been podcasting. I've been very busy.
You're
this
very
week.
Productive.
Every time I decide I want to do something positive about one of the sites I'm in control of, it falls over and I have to spend all of the time dealing with that instead. It's tiring. I had a little bit of a very tiny, sustained nervous breakdown Monday and Tuesday night, which was quite exciting.
Which is annoying for me because there's a thing I want you to read that I've done. And you just won't read it, and it's really listening, you know what it's like when you create something and you want someone to look at it before, in fact really there's nothing I can do with it until we agree what we're going to do with it, is there? It's a thing that might turn into a thing.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's horrible, isn't it? You've given birth to this thing, and you've left your charge with someone, but they're like, they don't want to know. They've left your charge, they've left your baby in a room upstairs, and they're watching EastEnders downstairs. And they're...
Making EastEnders
downstairs.
Works.
Smoking crack.
Not smoking crack. Making EastEnders and not sleeping.
Yeah.
It must be awful creating something, putting loads of work into something, creating it, and then not getting the feedback that you want from the world around you.
It sounds like you're beginning to empathise, which is good.
No.
Oh.
What I'm doing is I'm segueing into, you can talk to us about this podcast, about what you think of it, about what you think of comics, about what you think of cricket, apparently, is a thing that James talks to people about online.
I don't really understand.
I think you have. You can do that by emailing us at...
mumcast@gmail.com.
You can also send us 2 to 5 minute audio contributions. Put them in MP3 format. I mean, if you want to leave it in whatever weird format it comes out of your Apple device in. If I've got iTunes working on my computer at the time when we get it, I can convert it. At the moment, iTunes is spending a lot of time not working on all of the computers.
Yeah, no, mine too.
It's a bit weird.
Yeah, and destroying all the podcasts. I've chopped my podcasts down to almost nothing in an attempt to make my PC update my podcasts in less than an hour.
Blimey, that's a long time. Mm. It must be awful if someone cocks up their episode so you end up getting a rubbish version of the episode and then you have to get the better version of it, which may have happened to this show last week. Listener, if you listened to the broken version of the podcast last week, I'm very, very sorry.
But you can always go to the website where you can redeem just your right click of your... You can redeem your old copy for a shiny brand new version.
That's true, you can.
Yeah.
You can also stream all of the episodes from the website. So if you're sat at your computer and you don't want to faff with your podcatcher.
And the podcast app on iTunes is all right. The one you can have on your mobile device is actually all right.
Okay. So you can listen to all of our past episodes at the site. The site is momcomics.com. You can also see the show notes there. There are loads of show notes. They're very exciting. Show notes are very exciting.
Moderately.
If you click on any Amazon links on our site, we'll get a tiny little bit of money back if you buy something, which is quite nice. It goes towards hosting and stuff like that.
You said you were going to buy us a nice little getaway where only you and I would know about, and we could get away from the world, and we could shut the door on this horrible, terrifying world that we live in and just be together. What we'd have to do, though, if you and I did live together in a retreat, we'd have to record every conversation we had, though, because apparently that's what we do.
It's tax deductible.
Is it? Recording conversations?
James, we're not supposed to talk about this stuff where effectively we're talking about running away with all of the Mom funds. Yes. We're not supposed to talk about this stuff where the other two members of Mom can hear about it.
No, we're fine because we're talking about it on the podcast.
Oh, okay. Jane Mom isn't here this week. You can talk to Jane Mom on Twitter at Jane Mom. John Mom isn't here this week. That's J-O-H. No, it's not H. J-O-N-M-O-M-B. You can talk to him on Twitter as well. He's not on there very much. He's not here this week either. James Mom you can talk to on Twitter at...
St. Bonnyface.
James Mom. And it's a bit redundant if I say your names as Jane Mom and James Mom.
Mm. The Mom twins.
I'll go back and cut all that. And I'm Nick Sight on Twitter. You can talk to me on Twitter at Nick Sight. Spelt funny. Spelt in old internet styly.
Yeah.
Just imagine you were going to try and find someone called Nick Sight on MySpace. Spell it that way and you'll find me.
Or GeoCities.
Yes. We're also on Facebook and Google Plus and Tumblr. You can find links to all of those at the top right-hand corner of the Mom Comics site, which you can find at momcomics.com, which is at momcomics.com.
Part of Mom...
The dot is a full stop.
Part of Mom Industries.
Yes. 2014.
Yeah, word to your mother.
We have to change the domain like every year. Because we've kind of tied ourselves to this film 2014 styly thing.
Yeah, and I thought 20th Century Fox were idiots.
Those fucking idiots.
Yeah.
Should we talk about this week's comics?
We can talk about this week's comics. There's something that we could do.
It's me, isn't it, basically? I'm going to talk about this week's comics.
I'm looking forward to it, though.
I'm looking forward to it, too.
It's a big fucking bowl. They're all going to settle in.
I do a lot of reviews. I'm sorry.
It's terrible on a review show.
I try and do them quick, though. 2000 AD Prog 1871, because that's the year it was produced. Did you know that basically 2000 AD is so packed with content each week that it takes a full year in the past to produce each issue or prog? And so Prog 1871 was actually produced over the whole year of 1871, and sent to the future here using time travel. I think everyone gets the hang of the conceit now.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
It is amazing.
I did not know that. So thank you letting us in on that inside comic secret. Thank you, Nick.
That's okay. Yeah, so certain stories like Strontium Dogs and that other really annoying one that was running in it have finished. But what they've done in this issue, they've got a few continuing stories. Judge Dredd, ABC Warriors, and Grey Area are continuing. They're all okay. I mean, Judge Dredd's a good story at the moment with nice art by Nick Dwyer, written by Michael Carroll. But I guess they are gearing up to one of their great jumping on point issues where they start a whole bunch of new stories, because they've got both a Terror Tales, a one-shot Terror Tales, which is the horror version of a Future Shock, and the first of the first part of a three-part Thargs thriller called After the Vengeance.
They're usually very nice stories, but I hate that as a title.
It's a horrible title. Yeah. This one is written by my close personal friend, David Bailey.
Well, you were married for a number of years in the 90s, were you not?
Yes, yeah, we were, but I try not to talk about that. With art by John Davis Hunt, really nice art by John Davis Hunt. It's set in a dystopic, I guess, I don't know if it is a dystopic, an apocalyptic version of London in the near future, after a thing called the Vengeance, which is basically a day when everybody just got super pissed off with the government and the authorities and turned.
See, you say dystopic, I say that's utopian.
Very good, you commie bastard. And into this interesting political situation, we have a conscientious objector who is introduced by the end of this first part to a more down to earth and localized thriller story. It's good. I really like the first part. I can, more probably than most of these stories, I can totally see this as the first part of a three-act story. In most of the other stories, I felt like the first part suggested it was going to be a much bigger story. But this one, it fits quite nicely. You can see how it's going to play out. But obviously, my point of view is completely compromised by my relationship to the writer. Who, you know, it was all amicable.
It's lust, though, wasn't it? You can't build a relationship just on lust.
You can't, but the thing is, you never really forget your thirst.
Your thirst.
Or your 31st.
That's true.
He was about my 14th. There's also The Terror Tale is quite an interesting story. It's written by Keck W, which I don't think is a real name, with art by PJ Holden. Really nice art with, which I guess PJ Holden coloured, but it's a really nice similar colour palette to the one in Number Crunchers, which was coloured by Jordi Belair. So it's got that real, the colours used very sparingly to make stuff pop. It's really nice. I like it.
Good, I'm pleased for you, I really am.
That's 2080. I've talked more about that than I have the last few weeks because I enjoyed it a lot more than I have done the last few weeks. So, 2080, it was a better issue than I enjoyed it more than I have recent ones. I hesitate to say it's better. People have been enjoying it, I just really haven't. Rover Red Charlie number 4. It's $3.99 from Avatar. It's written by Garth Ennis with art by Michael DePascal. This is the story about the dogs in an apocalyptic US city. Well, they're in the countryside outside a US city at the moment. I've talked about every issue of this because it's so weird and kind of good, but kind of weird. A bit Watership Downy, but at the same time, Garth Ennis's willingness to push the boundaries of what's acceptable in a comic is present throughout. With this comic, when he does it, though, it feels almost a little bit too much. It's not that I'm unshockable, but I am quite unshockable. I don't mind really profane and gross stuff, but it feels a bit weird in this. It feels a bit weird when he does it in this, which is ultimately quite a sweet and stressful story about three dogs who have never had to do anything for themselves, trying to get by in a terrifying world. There hasn't been anything too out of place in it before, but in the previous issue to this one, there was a big, I guess, bulldog who had a human child that was subservient to it. And you kind of got the message without having to see some of the stuff that Ennis wrote to happen there. This issue is really different from that last issue. It is utterly heartbreaking, though. And especially you as a dog owner, and me as a dog owner, and me with my issues with animals being abandoned and stuff like that, this issue was hard work. Mm. We kind of always knew it was going to get this way because of what the story's about. But yeah, the other slightly weird thing about this comic, Michael DePascal's art is I don't think I like it very much at all. Mm. It's weird because sometimes they're beautifully rendered. I think the art is really nice. There are beautifully rendered images of everything, but the storytelling just doesn't always work because of it. They're like fully rendered paintings that don't move that much on the page, which can be a little bit weird.
Yeah, that's always the problem, isn't it?
She-Hulk issue 2 by Charles Soule and Javier Pulido. I don't know, Charles Soule has just come out of nowhere. I hadn't even heard of him before Letter 44, which I picked up because it looked interesting rather than because I'd heard of anybody on it. But two of my favourite books at the moment are written by him. So this is $2.99 from Marvel. It's part of their all-new Marvel Now range. And it's the story of Jennifer Walters, also known as She-Hulk, who has lost her job at the lawyer's firm, the attorneys.
Are you in New York? Are you attorneys?
I'm very confused. At the lawyer's firm that she was at, so she sets up on her own. And the first issue was just this really lovely idiosyncratic book that didn't feel that felt very much set in the Marvel, well, completely set in the Marvel universe. There were appearances by Tony Stark, and it's very much in that setting, but at the same time wasn't a typical Marvel book. It's the most like Hawkeye in that it's just kind of about this character's day-to-day life. The normal side to their life. It's particularly weird in the case of She-Hulk, though, because she doesn't really have an alter ego. Everyone knows who she is because she's always big and green. So, the flip side to that is that whereas in Hawkeye he still ends up dealing with gangsters and doing his bits of Hawkeye-iness, in the first issue of this, it was just a straight up legal drama. There was a suggestion of fisticuffs between Jennifer Walters and some robots, but it mostly happened off screen in a really nice comedy transition, like soft comedy transition. It reminds me of a really fun legal sort of fun legal dramedy,
like Boston Legal.
Yeah, and more like The Good Wife, except that it's difficult for people to write She-Hulk without making it a little bit funny, because she is quite a funny character.
I'm allowed to admit I quite like Boston. Is it Boston Legal in it with William Shatner in it?
I haven't ever seen it.
Oh God, I've got a really soft spot for it. I think it might be a bit trashy, but oh my God.
I try not to read reviews of comics online, because I tend to not like online comic journalism that much. But I was really interested to see how other people responded to this comic, the first issue of this comic, because it was so weird. Well, it's so unusual. It's not actually weird. It's perfectly normal. But it's so unusual in the milieu of superhero comics and just comics in general, really. But it seemed to me so clear, quality of it seemed so clear with the first issue, that I just wanted to see other people writing about it. I just knew in my heart that it would get like glowing reviews, and I wanted to see what other people made of it, because I felt like I maybe undersold it a little bit. And what actually happened was a lot of people said really nice things. I didn't read that many reviews. I could only really stomach two or three. People said really nice things about the art, about Pulido's art, and they said relatively nice things about the fact about Saul's writing and the general setting of it. But all of them complained that not that much, that there wasn't actually any action in it. And I kind of felt like maybe the way you should respond when you read something that you are happy to admit is really high quality. You're happy to admit that you enjoyed it and that it's really high quality, but there's one area where it isn't exactly like all the other comics that you spend a lot of time complaining about because they're all like each other. Then maybe you shouldn't be complaining that that thing is missing, because maybe the reason it's a good comic is because it doesn't have that stuff in it. And so it put my nose out of joint a little bit reading a couple of the reviews of it. People are entitled to their opinion, but it did seem a little bit weird.
Are they?
Are
they entitled to it?
Yes.
I would refer you to an episode of a podcast called Unanswered, where two men, more intelligent than me, discuss that very topic.
Okay, so I'm doing this one now. Don't mess with my dissociative identity disorder.
I didn't even know that was a thing until right then.
It just feels like if your instinct is that something's really good, you shouldn't be. If your instinct is that you enjoyed it and it's really good, you maybe shouldn't be looking for the things that are missing when it worked without those things. This issue kind of throws that out of the water a little bit, though, because it has a little bit of that scene-setting stuff of Jennifer Walters setting up her legal practice. The art is still gorgeous. The writing is still really great. The characterization of all of the characters is great. It has a little bit of that setup. But then Jennifer Walters meets up with her friend. She's having a bit of trouble. She's finding that her ability to set up this legal firm has been compromised by people by her previous employers bad mouthing her around town. So she ends up hooking up for drinks with her friend Patsy Walker, who is the superheroine Hellcat.
I love superheroine. It's so much more Norish than normal heroin. I thought I liked heroin until I had super heroin. I recommend it to all of my friends.
Okay. Hellcat is, it turns out, has even less to do than Jennifer Walters and wants to go out and beat something up. They want to go out and beat someone up and solve some crime. So there are fisticuffs in this comic. There are giant robots.
So essentially they're a 19-year-old boy that isn't having sexual intercourse with anyone.
Yeah, I guess.
Mm.
And so they go out, they get into a fight. There's some really amazing amazing moments in this. There's a great two-page, a great really unusual double-page splash towards the end of the comic, actually, that's really dynamic. It's just such a good comic. It's a really, really good comic. I like it a lot. I like She-Hulk a lot.
Put that on the cover. There you go.
Loki, Agent of Asgard, is great. It's Al Ewing writing, and he's got a really good handle on what he wants from this character. And it's got art by Lee Garbutt, with colour art by Nolan Woodard. The framing device in this issue is that Loki is talking to a lady at a speed dating thing. During the course of that, through flashback, he is describing to her the meat of the story in this issue that involves another Asgardian who's out in the world. Loki himself is on a mission that he's been sent on by the matriarchs of Asgard, and he kind of owes them, so he's become their agent. He's clearly got plans, though, that are kind of forming through this issue. And in the background, there is the legacy of the kid Loki, the things that happened at the end of Kieran Gillen's Journey into Mystery Run. I don't think you need to have read those to really get the sense of what's going on here. So each issue so far has been a really good self-contained little narrative with this wider-reaching stuff that's quite interesting. Loki's a really interesting character, and you can engage with him on a very immediate level as quite a snappy character, and then in this kind of interesting middle level where, like most good heist films and most well-written and sophisticated films, there's also subtext. He's got plans. He knows things that you don't know as the reader, but you find out about them by the end of the issue. That's good. So it works. He works as a fun character that you can read about. He works as this middle-range character where there's more going on than he's telling you, or than the writer's telling you, but there's also this overarching thing where there's things going on that he doesn't know about either, which is really interesting. And there's an introduction of someone who I think is going to be a really interesting supporting character who works as a perfect foil for Loki. The art is great as well, really nicely rounded, quite mainstream looking comic art, but really nice. Afterlife with Archie number 4. I'm really lucky that I read Rover Red Charlie yesterday and read this today, because there's dog-related zombie stuff going on in this issue as well. And had I read both of them in Starbucks on the same day, I would definitely have cried. I felt myself on the edge of it a little bit with this.
You don't want to be crying in Starbucks either, because that would really impede your chances of people chatting you up.
Yes. What is this thing about me being chatted up in Starbucks?
You're always, in my mind, getting chatted up by
Men
and women of Starbucks.
I'm very open to meeting people, and not like in a romantic sense. I'm just very open to the world. And
it's just
I think
sex.
People,
it's not romance, is it?
I think people understand that, and that's what draws them to me. So Afterlife with Archie number 4, written by Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa with artwork by Francesco Francavilla. This continues to be one of the best comics around. I have said it before, but it manages to be sympathetic to the all ages nature of Archie comics, although this isn't intended as an all ages comic. It doesn't do anything to completely subvert the characters that people are used to, although interestingly there is a brother sister relationship in this that I was not aware previously existed in the Archie universe, so I might have to go onto Wikipedia later and find out about that. But Archie goes to try and rescue his parents. Riverdale has been overtaken by zombies. Archie goes to try and rescue his parents. I was not aware that Archie had a dog before this issue. I'm sure he always has done in continuity, but we meet the dog in this issue, and he's called Vegas, and it's a really, really, really good issue that I found really upsetting. The writing is great, but very spare. There's like a lot is left to the art, and Francesco Francavilla's art is just amazing. Very bold use of colour, incredibly bold use of colour, and just really striking, a very striking comic. That's issue 4 now, and it's $2.99. If you can find the first 3 issues, which I know have been reprinted to hell, definitely worth it. My main comic that I didn't even know anything about before I was in the shop on Wednesday was a comic from Dark Horse called Vale. It's the first issue. It's $3.50, and it's written by Greg Rucka, which is what drew me to it, with art by someone I've never heard of called Tony Fezzula. At first glance, the art is the most striking thing about this, really. It's so unusual. It's fully painted, but very, very expressive. It reminds me of art I saw years ago by Mark Chiarello, who I think is better known as a colorist and an editor, I think, actually. It's I don't really have the words to explain it, but it's much more fine arty than most comics are. I'm not sure about the story at the moment. We are introduced to a character who identifies herself as Vale. She's naked to begin with. She seems to become self-aware at the same time as we're introduced to her, and she finds her way out of the sewers. I guess it's New York. I think it's New York. But she finds herself out of the underground. It's not the sewers, it's the underground. Surrounded by rats. Walks out onto a busy city street, completely naked. We find that she's clearly, she's very strong at this point. She's at the moment, she's kind of a blank slate character, which made me feel a little bit, if it was written by anyone other than Greg Rucka, I would be slightly uncertain where a book that has its main female protagonist completely naked for most of the first issue and apparently having no real character, being a complete blank slate. She's just kind of gibbering, rhyming, not really making a lot of sense. what she emerges from the underground city into is a quite busy, quite seedy street, and instantly finds herself in this situation where there are quite aggressive men who obviously notice her because she's a naked woman, and another man who takes it on himself to look after her. But there's also the threat of these alpha males who are also interested in her. And it quickly becomes clear that this isn't going to be a straight-up drama. This is probably going to be a horror comic. I really don't know where this is going to go, but because it's Greg Rucka, I kind of trust this to be more than just a really straightforward doll-like, dollhouse-like female protagonist-led comic. He did have a little essay in the... He has got like a few paragraphs in the back where he explains... I didn't actually finish reading it because I had to get back to work. But where he does admit that although this character or this idea has been with him for a very long time, for 20 years, unlike anything else he's written, he doesn't know what... It's being written, I think, in a very loose way. Normally, the thing with Greg Rucka is his characters are very fully formed. And I think in this, he's got the idea and the characters emerging from that rather than the other way around. It's really interesting, though. I liked it. I think I'm gonna get more of them. But it's that $3.50 price point where it's gonna have to keep me really hooked in the way that $2.99 books don't. I hate to keep going on about it, but I clearly don't because I keep going on about it. Magneto number one, $3.99. I got the Scotty Young cover. It's because it's a Marvel book, so of course it's got a Scotty Young cover on the first issue. This is, I'm not sure what the continuity is going on with Magneto at the moment. I don't really care either. It doesn't really seem to matter for this. It's written by Cullen Bunn with art by Gabriel Hernandez-Walter, who I've loved since... I think the first time I saw their art was The Suicide Forest or something. There was a three-part horror story I read way, way back. I talked about it on the show a very long time ago. With colour art by Jordi Belair. I'm just going on the assumption that Gabriel Hernandez Walter is a man, but that might be a woman's name, I suppose. That they've got a really idiosyncratic style, but it is changing over time, but it's still really unique as well. It's got this kind of weird woodcut feel to it, which is really, really nice. And Jordi Belair's color really brings a lot to it as well. This is the story of... It's kind of a bit like the anti Highway to Heaven, or you know, the old TV series of the Hulk, in that it seems to be, and there's a little bit of Nazi hunter type thing going on as well. This is Magneto going around small town America, tracking down people who have enabled hate crimes against mutants and punishing them. Basically vigilanteing on their asses.
Now this is why I saw someone on Twitter say, okay, so basically now Magneto's Marvel's... No, now Magneto's the X-Family's version of the Punisher.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a surf... That's a little bit of a superficial read of it, because it's...
Seems more like Ewa-Wewa.
It's actually... It's not really like that. It's very evocative of... And I think partly because Magneto is kind of tied to this whole Holocaust narrative as well, both literally and, you know, metaphorically through the mutants as well, and through the way the mutants have been persecuted. That it's you don't have to look as far as the Punisher or the Equalizer for the analog to this. There are Nazi hunter narratives. These are people who think that they've left behind their crimes against this species or this group, and he's tracking them down. So it's not really like street justice sort of stuff. through this, there's the awareness that S.H.I.E.L.D. are after him as well. There's some really interesting visualizations of Magneto's powers that, you know, they have a lot of potential to be really visually interesting, but they also have a lot of potential to be really visually overdone. One of my favorite things about when artists are visualizing telekinetic or other sorts of powers that move things with the power of the mind, one thing I really like is when you don't see the power streams. You know, you don't see this purple light coming off his head that's moving stuff, which some artists do, but that doesn't really happen in this, so I quite like it. And also, he's got a pin board. That's how you know he's not like the Punisher or the Equalizer. He's more like an investor. He's more like trying to track these people down. He's got a pin board. You've got to respect someone who stays in motel rooms and has a pin board.
I don't know. I mean, it depends. I mean, this is, I imagine, set in a contemporary Marvel universe.
Mm-hmm.
Can't he plot that in some sort of handheld device?
He's an old dude.
I know, but surely he's Magneto. You would have thought he'd be able to manipulate, like, you
well,
know.
Look, I can't even wear a watch for very long without
how
it breaking.
How cumbersome's a probably, fucking pin board?
Not when you've got the power of your mind.
You
not
mean,
really comes
so it's not a cork pin board, then it's going to be some sort of metal-based.
No, he just pins stuff to the wall. He's only in motels. Like, and he's
yeah,
got,
but he's got to move from motel to motel. He's got, like, a fucking pin board around with him.
James, he's old school.
He's a twat.
I think he's just pulling the pins around with him.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, you've called him a twat now, so you've spoiled my review.
Put it on the cover.
I really liked Magneto.
Moon Knight, I think he's a jerk.
Moon Knight number one, $3.99, written by Warren Ellis with art by Declan Shalvey and colour art by Jordi Belair. I think this was one of the real anticipated books, certainly from Marvel, of the week.
I know Larry from Larry's Comics said, "This ain't your daddy's Moon Knight." My daddy didn't read Moon Knight,
no,
mate.
I don't know.
I don't know what your daddy read.
I don't know
read.
What he's really talking
My
about.
My daddy didn't read Moon Knight.
This is great. I really enjoyed the Brian Michael Bendis and Alex Maleev run on Moon Knight, but it was kind of one that was true to the past of the character, I think, but really did change things. It took the idea that he had some form of dissociative identity disorder and was who he believed that he was on missions with Spider-Man and Wolverine and Captain America, but actually he was all of them. And this kind of follows on from that, but has really satisfying in-story reasons why they don't have to stick to that particular version of the character. They've also visually changed how he looks. They've lost the cowl, and now he's just kind of got a hood and a suit. He looks kind of like a Warren Ellis character. It's not dissimilar to how Snow looked in Planetary, really. But you know, it looks great anyway. He's kind of a bit more like Batman as well. He's got a car that he talks to, not like Knight Rider, but like he's got a car that's quite automated, and he's using. There's been this. It's been in Moon Knight continuity for a while that he's got. He's very, very rich. Maybe since the beginning, I don't know, but that he's very, very rich, and Warren Ellis is having a little bit of fun with the fact that he actually has a lot of resources at his disposal. He's not bumming it or slumming it anywhere. He's got a big base of operations and some pretty high tech stuff at his disposal. The story is a down the line detective story, and it's very satisfying. It reminded me a lot of. It's hard not to relate it to other Warren Ellis work. And it does feel, the story feels a lot like his book Fell from Image. There's actual investigation going on, and it feels really satisfying. And considering it's a Marvel book that isn't going out under one of their adults-only imprints, it's dark enough. It's pretty dark. The Declan Shalvey's art is interesting because I really know him from... I really know his work mainly from the Conan issues he did, I think, but also from the Deadpool issues he did, and I really liked his style in that, but it was much more expressionistic in I'm probably not using that term properly at all, but it was very, it was kind of unusual and used lots of very expressive shapes and stuff in it. Whereas this is much clearer. He's changed his style a little bit, still recognisably his, but it's hard to tell how much of how he's laying out the pages is coming from Warren Ellis's script and how much of it is coming from Declan Shalvey, but it's the storytelling is great, the art is gorgeous, the colour, unsurprisingly, is really, really good, although the palette is much fuller than you sometimes see Jordi Belair use, but no, it's good. It's a gorgeous looking book. It's I really like this iteration of Moon Knight. There are going to be plenty of people talking about how good it is, and plenty of people who are going to be picking holes in it because so many people are talking about how good it is, but I enjoyed it, so that's why I'm talking about it. It's good.
Good. That's nice.
And the good thing is the design on it is just the design on it is so striking. I think what happens is, I think there's a reason Warren Ellis books kind of look similar to each other, even though he works with lots of different artists. And I think part of it is probably he's got an idea of how he wants books to look and probably gives a lot of guidance. But I think that working with him probably gives you freedom to use these really expressive sorts of cover designs and interior designs, the way that credits are handled within the comics and stuff like that. The visual motifs and the way they play out is very cinematic in a way that people working with Warren Ellis kind of brought to comics in the late 90s, you know. Although Brian Hitch was an amazing artist, he didn't really kick off to the style that he's ended up being really well known for, the page layouts and the storytelling that he's known for, until he worked on The Authority with Warren Ellis. And that's not going to be because Warren Ellis was telling him exactly what to draw, although there might have been some of that in there. But it will have definitely been, look, I want to write a really cinematic comic. You're going to get to draw this really expressive comic. We also got the first... We got a preview of Overrun.
Yes.
Written by Andy Ewington.
Who is the first ever non-mom voice.
Yes, he was.
On the Momcast.
Written by Andy Ewington with Matt Woodley, who co-wrote it with him, and art by Paul Green. I know he's been working on this a really long time, and it's a really high-concept comic book, and one that you could probably only really get away with in comics, because it's a comic that's set in the world of computers, inside the computers. And all of the characters in this city that is a city representation of the inside of computers. There's the authorities in it are the government building is the CPU. You've got MP3 files who are very hip and musical, and zip files who actually have a zip motif on their clothes. JPEG files, the image that they represent is on the t-shirt that they're wearing.
Are MP4s a bit porny?
No, there are spam files and infected files, and the comparisons to the world of Tron are kind of unavoidable. It's kind of a bit more like The Matrix, but that's not really fair either. I have to be honest, when I was hearing about this and reading it, I was kind of thinking, this is going to annoy me. I think this is going to annoy me. Because if it's a really high concept, and that's fine, and it's good, and it's interesting.
Yeah.
But if it's approached in a pretty straight way, it's just going to be daft. Even at the time, Tron probably wasn't that coherent, really, in a real world sense, because that was done at a time when computers were magical, and The Matrix kind of gets away with it because it uses a lot of Hong Kong cinema imagery, but this is actually supposed, this isn't humans in a machine, this is software in a machine. And so I had my misgivings, but what's actually happened is it feels to me like what Ewington's doing in this is, I'm going to call him Ewington to pretend that we don't actually know him personally.
Boom.
What Ewington does in this is he's not really going for a particularly straight representation of what we think goes on in a computer. He's not even pretending that it's that serious. It's very allegorical. There's a real, although the stakes are real in it, and there's a very dramatic narrative going through it where there's a character who wakes up, he doesn't know who he is or where he is, but he's in this world, and there's also an infection and a conspiracy, all of which may have very real stakes for the people within this city. The touch on the world, the way the world is represented, is handled in a relatively light way. I don't think it's unfair to say that it's handled in quite a shallow way. Not in that, I don't mean that it's really simplistic, but by shallow I mean that you're not supposed to, I don't think you're supposed to think too hard about, well, but that's not how MP3s work. You know, that's not how software really works. This isn't how these things engage. It's literally just set up like that. It's kind of an allegorical world, and he's using this setting, which is quite blunt, really, to have some fun. There's a thriller playing out through it, but also there are lots of little jokes that he's playing with, puns and wordplay and stuff like that. All of which is, I think my problem initially was, you look at Tron and you look at The Matrix. These are films that take themselves very, very seriously, and because in that setting you have to kind of get some stuff right or else it ends up looking a bit daft. But this isn't taking that side of the story that seriously, I don't think. There's a situation where there are computer game characters who are all hanging out in this pad, and they're the most interesting of all of the characters you meet, really. The characterization on them is really, really nice. But at that point it's clear that, like, okay, well, sometimes we're talking about these files being very, like, almost drone like. They're people, but in a very loose sense, they're very kind of representative. You're not supposed to think of them as individuals, really. But then you get these computer game characters, and they're really bright and vibrant and interesting. And then through this, you've got this potentially quite horrific and dangerous story of this guy who's a fugitive, but who is also wrapped up in all of this extra stuff. He's using this world that I thought I was not going to like, really, in a way that's, I think, quite effective. Also, he manages to not overdo the puns and the wordplay, because I don't know if you remember, it hasn't come up in a really long while, but I'm completely pun blind. I don't like them. I can't do them.
It's hilarious.
I can't do them. I don't like them. I just don't get it. And I was actually thinking, oh, that's clever, I see what he's done there, rather than thinking, oh, for fuck's sake, which was quite nice. The art, it reminds me a lot of J. Scott Campbell. I don't think it's unfair to say that. The artist was clearly inspired by J. Scott Campbell, but it looks really gorgeous. The storytelling's pretty good. It's a good comic. I'm looking forward to it. I think it's coming out as one book, though, which is interesting. I'm not sure what the price point on that's going to be, but it's definitely going to be worth taking a look at. And I think it's got some quite mainstream, quite commercial potential.
Yeah.
Which is nice. Which is good, I think.
It's exciting. It's been a long journey.
You haven't got any comics, have you?
So any what?
Comics.
What are they?
So we've slammed straight into the awkward middle bit.
Yeah, I've got nothing for you there. I mean, Rob Liefeld, I know, this week.
No.
I don't think you're going to stop me for a minute.
No, I'm going to stop you.
He spoke about baseball quite a bit.
I will stop the fuck out of you.
If you like. What have you got there?
I picked up a comic this week. Well, I think I ordered it last week and it turned up today. It is a bumper size, like a magazine size collection.
A four size look.
Pretty bare bones collection of an old comic, which I think was in Eagle. Yes, the first 24 issues of the Eagle comic that relaunched in the 1980s, which I got every issue of. It's very exciting. But it's...
I probably did. I mean, I've long lost them.
It's the...
Because Doom Lord made me shit my pants.
It's The Tower King, written by Alan Hebden, who I think worked at 2000 AD as well, or has worked at 2000 AD as well, and illustrated by Jose Ortiz, who is one of the artists who I really, really remember fondly from the 1980s. I think when Doom Lord transitioned from being a photo story to being comic art, he might have done some of that.
Stopped being shit your pants terrifying.
But he definitely did a comic called The 13th Floor. He's got a very European, sounds ridiculous because British comics European as well, strictly speaking, aren't they? But a very European style to it. The Tower King was, I'm not going to pretend I remember really clearly, I haven't had a chance to reread this yet, but The Tower King is the story of Mick Tempest. I'm just going to read it off the back. Story of Mick Tempest and his attempts to bring order to a modern-day London plunged into medieval anarchy by the total loss of electricity. The thing I really, really remember about this comic, actually, was it was similarly to the three-parter that David Bailey just started in 2002 this week, which goes on the premise that... which bounces off the premise that most people are only 9 square meals away from anarchy. Most societies are only 9 square meals away from anarchy or something.
I'd say
like
at least 6 less than that.
Yeah. This, as I recall, what happens is electricity stops working. In fact, it's very similar to the TV series Revolution. Electricity stops working. People are instantly medieval. People just lose their shit completely. They don't know how to cope at all.
Don't you think medieval is not like a default mode, though? I agree with that. I think that's what we would default back to. It'd be feudalism and eating mud.
Mm. So this is interesting because it creates this setting that's almost steampunky in that... We've still got tanks and stuff around, but we have to find other ways of making all of that stuff
horse-drawn tanks
work. Certain technology can still be adjusted and made to work, but generally most people don't know
how to replace. So electricity's gone.
We're not engineers. We don't know how to...
I mean, how does electricity just disappear, though? Do you know what I mean?
I don't know.
Like, the technology of electricity just disappears.
Ask J.J. Abrams.
Electrons and shit no longer sort of, you know, clash into each other and make your telly work.
It's to do with satellites and microwaves.
I'm sorry, that sounds like a lot of bullshit to me, mate.
It's not. That's just the high concept on which this is
based. It sounds quite implausible, though, I'm afraid. I'm afraid because of those reasons I'm out, Nick.
Look, I don't care.
I need plausibility in my stories.
This isn't a spotlight. It isn't a review. I'm just saying. I got this week. It's a really nice collection of a comic that is long out of print. I'm not entirely sure how they've managed the licensing on it. I suspect that because it's a 200 print run, that might be how they've got away with it. Gorgeous black and white comics. This is Jose Ortiz definitely did The 13th Floor, which is misspelled on the back of this, but it's only a 200 print run, so it doesn't matter. But he definitely did The 13th Floor, which I think a lot of people who were reading British comics in the 80s might remember. That was about a building that had a skyscraper that had an artificial intelligence in charge of it, and it didn't have a 13th floor because apparently some skyscrapers don't. But basically, as the artificial intelligence saw people behaving badly around the thing, say there was someone being menaced by an outsider, it would get them when they were in the lift. It would take them to the 13th floor that didn't exist and then terrify them to death with visions.
Did he specialise?
It was fucking awesome.
Did he specialise in illustrating highly implausible comics?
James, all comics were highly implausible in the 1980s.
No.
Unlike now, where they're all perfectly reasonable.
Very much. Well, Watchmen changed all that, didn't it?
The reason I... Yes. The reason I heard about this was because Lee Gallagher mentioned it on Facebook.
Oh, Lee Gallagher. Oh.
What I didn't realise at the time was...
You wouldn't let me have a moment there, would you? I was just, I went on a little moment of reverie there.
What I didn't realise at the time was that Lee Gallagher does the foreword in this. So he was basically just shilling his foreword.
How often does he mention masturbation in that foreword?
Don't know, I haven't had a chance to read it yet. It wasn't a review. I just wanted to tell you about it. I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
Next week, come back and tell us how many masturbation mentions there are in his
forward. I don't think there are any. I think he's just talking about his relationship with Jose Ortiz, which is interesting because when you see Lee Gallagher's art, you can...
All of which is very plausible.
You're so tiresome. When you see Lee Gallagher's art, you can see that his influences are quite classical. Jose Ortiz, I just keep pronouncing it differently.
Right. Come on, you've got one job.
I don't have to get it right, but it would be helpful if I could at least get it consistently wrong. That would be good.
I'm just assuming that you're going through three options, and when you get home tonight, you're going to find out which is right. You're going to edit in the correct one into each of the
options. Jose Ortiz.
He does this pretty much with everything he does, listener. He has three or four goes at everything.
It takes 3 weeks to edit each episode of the Mindcast.
We're actually recording this in 1845. It takes a full year for us to record it. And then we essentially send it with the same courier company as 2000 AD to the future. I am very much enjoying Queen Victoria's reign. I don't know about you.
I didn't realise she had control of the weather.
She has control of everything. God bless her.
It's a gorgeous looking comic. I'm actually looking forward to reading it. I flicked through the first few episodes, thought, wow, I don't remember this. I just kind of remember the main character. And then I flicked through the last few chapters and thought, these are burned into my memory. I totally recognise these. So it's interesting. It was a good period to be growing up in England as a comic person.
Yeah, it was indeed.
Politically speaking, it was shit.
Awful, dreadful, dreadful.
Beginning of the end, really.
Really, very, very much so. Where did it all go wrong, Billy Bragg says?
Probably about 10 or 15 years
somewhere
before
Somewhere in the
then.
80s, when the great and the good let way to the greedy and the mean.
I think they were all already there and letting go. I think it all... Never mind, I'm not interested.
Isn't that great? You know, it really, really isn't cool.
What are you doing?
It's just an economic union that's passed its sell-by date, Nick. That's what he says.
Are you Billy bragging at me?
I might be take down the Union Jacking at you.
You make me so angry.
I'd rather take down the Union Jack than Fleetwood Mac.
How many episodes have you been waiting to make that joke? All of them.
What are we on?
228.
Almost 5 years, Nick. I've been sitting here almost 5 years waiting to make that fucking joke.
Every now and then, we talk about digital comics. Normally when John comes on to talk about digital comics. But every now and then we talk about digital comics. When we talk about them, I have seemed like a bit of a Luddite. I have been uncomfortable with the idea that by buying into any one online publisher's ecology... that I would only be buying the license to a comic, that I wouldn't be able to access it whenever I wanted. Today we found that Comixology were hacked and all of everybody's passwords were compromised, so they are urging people to change their passwords, which is good, is very responsible of them. Unfortunately, when I went in to try and change my password for an account that I only ever use when I have to, because I don't really like digital comics, I couldn't get on because their infrastructure is such that it isn't really designed to have everybody who uses it to go on and change their passwords at once.
Well, that's perfectly acceptable if we hadn't had the almost this exact same conversation, albeit for a different reason. About a year ago, didn't something similar happen?
It was Marvel Comics. One of the publishers, I think it was Marvel, made bunch of their stuff available for free or very cheap.
So the infrastructure still can't handle peaks.
I'm sorry, that's
getting into the realms of BS, isn't it?
No, I mean...
Because it's, you know, once, okay, fair enough, you've been caught out.
This isn't... I imagine they're different parts of... I imagine they're different parts of their setup. The bit that's about people logging in and changing their passwords and their I can't remember the word, but what their account is validated against to allow them to use it and have access to all of their stuff is probably a different part from the it's not streaming when it comes to comics, but from that side of things.
Yeah,
so it's like the difference between being able to log in and the difference
between being able to access stuff. It very much depends what's causing the failure in terms of, like, if it's traffic and then it could be a similar issue.
I'm sorry, are you a programmer or a web person?
No, but I have a job where I'm involved in looking at IT systems. I have a part. Oh God, that was me. I have a passing knowledge of how these things work.
Okay, I was only joking.
Not in depth, though. I'm sorry, sir.
I'm sorry. I mean, I don't know for sure. I'm just saying it might be that they've dealt with the traffic issues when people are trying to access actual content, but that might be a different part from when you're going in to try and validate your password.
Potentially,
or that
absolutely.
Stuff. This isn't Shade and Frauder necessarily. I think it's pretty bad. I didn't like having to go in and having to deal with password stuff anyway. But people do get hacked. I'm not trying to say that Comixology are insecure or that any of this digital comic stuff is insecure. It's just that it begs mentioning. It's something that's happening today. And I think it's stuff like this that is why I'm always going to be a little bit paranoid about not having physical copies of stuff.
Cool. Well, thank you. And if you've got any content for Nick's new segment, I Told You So, then please do feel free to mail it to us at momcomics@gmail.com.
How long do you want for your spotlight?
Oh, I don't know. Give me 10 minutes.
10 minutes. Wow, you called me. You texted me twice. And
yeah,
you phoned me.
Yeah, why do you think when I bumped into you, so we were coming in, I said, you don't reply to my texts or answer my calls?
I thought you were just talking nonsense.
All right. Well, I was afterwards when you just didn't seem to know what was going on.
10 minutes.
Yeah, gone. If I use it, I use it. If I don't, I don't.
If you use it, you lose. If you don't use it, you lose it. That's the saying.
Do you know, I've been sat here so long listening to you talk about all the books, Nick. My coccyx has essentially snapped at this point. It's really quite painful. My little monkey tail. I can't see that over there. I mean, it's good for you. It works for you, but I mean,
you're on 0945
There's a mixing desk. I'm going to take a pause from library books just for 1 week because it's my birthday this week, and one of the books I was bought was Daughter of Her Father's Eyes by Mary M. Talbot and Brian Talbot. It says on the cover here, shortlisted for the 2012 Costa Biography Award. But from my in-depth research I've done, I know that it won the Costa 2012 Biography Award.
Oh, this is an older edition.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I think this is a first edition, which I'm very pleased to...
Well, they couldn't have put it in for the award. Well, maybe they could have before it had been published. So if that's the first edition...
What are we talking about now?
I don't know. Talk about the comic.
Yeah, it's written by Mary M. Talbot, whom is the partner, the wife of Brian Talbot, who is probably more well known in this particular milieu. The name Brian Talbot always makes me feel fuzzy in my tummy, to be honest with you. Not because I'm that familiar with, like, Granville or Alice in Sunderland or his other work, but
Taylor One Bad Rap.
Yeah, but because of a marvellous encounter I had with him. He wouldn't have known I had an encounter with him at Bix 2009 when he was quite drunk, I think, at the pre-con party, and was being really quite marvellous outside talking to one of the organisers. He really is an extremely wonderful presence to be around. He was hilarious.
I spilt his drink on him at a convention once, and he was very nice about it.
I think he's entirely lovely. I really rather like him, and I probably like him even more so after reading this book. This is a biography and a memoir, and it's Mary Talbot telling the story of both her upbringing and the upbringing of Lucia Joyce, James Joyce's daughter. Mm-hmm. And throughout the book we see echoing of each other's lives. Joyce is a huge figure in Talbot's life, though, because her father was James Atherton, who was a renowned scholar and wrote and spoke about James Joyce at length. In fact, at one point during the book it says when the Encyclopedia Britannica required a entry for James Joyce, it's Atherton they went to complete it. He was a well-respected man. However, he was an intense scholar. And this is the story of a father and a daughter, and a daughter's experience growing up as very much the younger child. She was younger by some way from her brothers. So it seems to, in some ways, as an only child myself, so I look at some aspects of this book and there are almost echoes with growing up as an only child, frankly. But her father, although clearly quite a warm and giving man in his professional field, when he was at home and it was his studying time, he was an irascible and difficult man to get through to. So you see her life told in, obviously, when you go in a time, you start here, sort of chronological. Jesus, that was hard. Words are so difficult, listener.
For the first few seconds, I didn't realise you were trying to find a word.
Yeah.
I was just hypnotised by your voice.
Yeah, no, words are so incredibly difficult. So the book is framed, really, with her as a student reading about Lucia Joyce. And then we go back and we look at their two lives echoing each other. Obviously, Joyce living a life of... I was going to say a life of privilege, but to start with, a life of extreme hardship before Joyce got it, and which is where their lives really have their closest connections, really. She grew up in Preston, part of a middle-class family, but still at a time post-war where, you know, there really was genuine austerity. You know, we talk about austerity now. There is most definitely hardship in the country, in the world now. But I think you look back at the austerity of the 40s and 50s, and it really was, you know, by any measure, you know, even relatively well-to-do people were living in what we would consider poverty now.
How much worse was it mathematically?
It was 65.86 recurring percent worse than it is now,
right,
which is a lot, really.
It is a lot worse.
It is. If I had more than 5 minutes, I would tell you how I came to that figure. And it's beautifully evocative, beautifully drawn by Brian Talbot. And actually, there are some really moving parts. It's really, really candid, really interestingly written. Mary Talbot has mostly written for academic journals and books and so forth. So it doesn't necessarily... Obviously, she's married to quite a well-known comiker, but she has a... There's a freedom to the way she writes that I found quite refreshing. There's a really lovely mix of prose and dialogue, which makes the story flow in a very dreamlike way. When you're reading this, you feel like you're going back into the recesses of someone's memory. I kind of felt like I was, you know, hovering, looking in on her life, kind of reliving these sort of dreamy sort of memories with her. It was really evocative. It really beautifully done. But that is helped no end by Talbot's art. The colouring changes between the two different stories. So Lucia is in a very sort of, it's a sort of blue ink, very, very neat, very well finished style. That kind of reminds me of most of the stuff of his that I've seen.
Yeah.
Whereas hers, although it's written in a, it has a softer feel to it, but also there's a real, and I think like a level, there feels like a level of intelligence in the art of this that I don't think I've necessarily seen elsewhere, because also there's a roughness to it. There's pencil lines that aren't quite erased. You know, some of the panels almost have a sort of semi-finished look to them that creates this really interesting contrast between this relatively small and quiet life that Mary was living with her father, who, you know, a brilliant mind, to this massive bohemian crazy life that Lucia was living with the Joyces in Paris and the very various places they lived. So that the art itself frames that beautifully. It's a really intelligent and clever use of the art. What I also enjoy as well is, rather than making Brian go back and do redraws when things weren't quite right, there's footnotes and there's arrows pointing to things. There's a lovely one early on where her mother is wearing a frilly apron, and there's a note saying, "My mother would never have worn a frilly apron, far too frivolous for her tastes." So also Mary, she really creates a really the character she becomes in her teens is really alluring as well. I could really connect it. Very rebellious, really resentful of her parents as well. Even though, you know, her parents appear to have had her best interests at heart, they were just a little bit too reserved to really be as open as maybe she would have wanted, which really echoes Lucia, who was brought up initially in his very free bohemian lifestyle. Her parents, as they get older, appear to become more conservative, living in the 1920s as they did when she was sort of reaching the blossom of her youth. And she wants to go off, become a dancer and so forth, but it's her parents' conservatism that kind of seems to lead, it is suggested in this book, to Lucia's downfall and eventual decline into a series of unfortunate mental health issues that she had for the rest of her life. Mary has a much happier tale, and it's really charming towards the end as she meets Brian. They have their children, and obviously she's had a very positive and glittering academic career as well. But it's obviously award-winning, very well received critically. It is a wonderful, wonderful book. Beautifully done. I look forward to reading. Apparently Mary M. Talbot has more work in the pipeline. Not necessarily going to be illustrated by Brian either, but she has a wonderful mind and a wonderful intellect that really shines through in this book. It is a real treat. If you get an opportunity to read it or buy it, I recommend it. It's published by Jonathan Cape and is available for $14.99 or less than that, if you know where to go, if you know what I mean. I can't recommend it highly enough. It was a wonderful present. I'm very happy to have it.
It sounds almost like an academic text. Well, not an academic text, but it sounds more like a literary biography than you'd normally expect to see in comics.
It is, but so much more accessible than that, I have to say. It's really very intelligently put together, but just flows so quick. It's a real sort of, it runs to, I think, about 90 pages, but it's one of those, you'll start it and you won't really, you're not going to close it again until you've finished it.
That sounds riveting.
Oh, it's wonderful.
I thank you for that was awesome, James. And nice that you've finally been able to get a book that was given to you, or that you own, rather than one that you had to borrow from somewhere.
I like borrowing books from somewhere, though. That's nice, too.
I know, so you do.
Tell you what, I was very lucky, and I've got the first three Preacher books as well, because I don't own Preacher, strangely enough. But
that's it. It was Preacher that introduced us to each other.
It was. It's kind of Preacher that grabbed me back into comics as well. But I've got caught up in that sort of, they're redoing it. So I've got the first three, the slightly bigger editions that they're bringing out now. Someone bought me the fourth one. The fourth one isn't out, so I've got a duplication there. So,
oh, that's interesting.
Which was not really.
I signed up. I should have put this in the awkward middleware, but I signed up this week to a MOOC, which is a massively online open course. It's very education, further education, higher education, lifelong learning sort of thing. You do the whole course remotely. It's essentially describing what the Open University has been doing for years, but it's given it a more modern sounding sort of acronym. But I signed up for one. Crucially, you decide how much work you put into them, and many of them are free. I signed up for one which is Social Issues Through Comic Books on the Canvas Network. It has some famous comic people involved doing lectures. I think it was Mark Waid who mentioned it online. I think he's one of the lecturers. And the people who put it together have done a few MOOCs, I think, up till now. But this was the first one that really interested me. The name of it really interested me. It's stupid. It's
You're
a stupid
a MOOC.
Acronym. Education comes up with the worst acronyms.
And these goddamn MOOCs.
Yep. That's the extent of my American accent. Yep. He's got them MOOCs. What the fuck is a MOOC?
You fucking MOOC.
So anyway, so that's exciting. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. It might be interesting. And the good thing is that if I fail to do anything to it, the only person I'm letting down is myself.
You keep saying the word interesting like you don't know what it means. It's incredible.
You made me think very much of it. Because when you talk about books, especially books like that one, you sound a lot more intelligent than I think you are.
Yeah, well, there's
and I don't.
Well, it's this script you write me, Nick. It's very hard not to.
I don't know how far you got with your academic career.
Oh, I left school.
But there are dumber graduates than you.
I left school.
You left school.
They allowed me to leave school.
Okay, at the. It's just something that you could do. You could get some letters after your name. Do you have some letters after your name?
Well, I've got some letters in my name. I don't know how many more letters I need.
It's not the be-all and end-all or even the end-all or the be-all.
I'd like to change my name, surname hyphenated, the second part of the hyphenated name be Ondive, just so I can have some letters after my name.
That was shit. What are you doing this week?
I'm going to be working on more of these carefully scripted ad-libs.
Excellent.
My mum's taking me out to buy me a meal because it was my birthday this week, so she's buying me a meal with the rest of my family.
Happy meal?
They're going to watch. No, we're going to a Frankie and a Benny's because we've got a kid, and when you've got a kid, you can only go to restaurants where you get balloons.
Is that true?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
You'll find out.
I'm going to be spending some time with my family.
Lovely.
I don't think we've got anything planned this weekend, which means that something will happen.
We could have done something. Maybe we should do something on Sunday.
We'll see. We'll see. I might be busy.
Fucking hell.
Thank you, listener. You have been brilliant, as always, just sitting there listening or walking. You can be walking. It's the future.
You could be doing any manner of things.
You could be driving.
You could be. For all we know, we might have some really wealthy listeners who have swimming pools with speakers under the water. They could be swimming while they're listening to this.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Yeah.
I don't think any of our listeners have a swimming pool.
Working in a JCB or a tractor. Maybe in a skyrocket.
Or in a skyscraper.
In a skyscraper.
Or they could be skydiving.
Oh, I'd like to know. Where's the most crazy place you've listened to? No, don't bother.
James, a pleasure as always.
And likewise, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The way it is.
What are you trying to ask me to do?
What am I doing with my fingers?
I don't know.
A dial?
You're trying to screw the cap of a very tiny jar of preserves.
I'm dialing.
Dialing.
Volume.
You'd like me to turn something down? Here we go.
Turn us down. I'm going to cut all this bit.
Oh.
I might not. I mean, I don't know.
I quite like the bit about the small pot of preserves.
You're really popping.
Well, I can't help it. I'm 39, mate. I'm very, very windy.
I don't know what's going on.
Squirm, I don't feel like I'm getting my money, what's it called? Return on investment. Money for bang for my buck. Do longer. You can edit all that out. That's fine.